Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I'm going to read 12.1 again, and then we'll look at the Sarvasambhadani for that paragraph. I'll just read the English. We should consider the authoritative sound of the Vedas is impossible for anyone in present times to study completely. Its meaning is difficult to construe, and even the sages who have explained it in commentaries disagree among one another. Okay, it's impossible for anyone to study all the Vedas. One reason is that in the Kali Yuga not all the Vedas are available, but even what's available is too much for anybody to study. Okay, continuing. For these reasons, we would be well advised to turn our attention to the Shabda Pramana of the Itihasas and Puranas, which are substantially non-different from the Vedas, and which definitively explain what the Vedas mean. Since the Vedic texts, whose purport is not self-evident, can be deciphered by reference to the Itihasas and Puranas, the Itihasas and Puranas are the appropriate sources of correct knowledge for our times. Okay, and then this is only a short comment in the Sarvasambhadani. Atayavam pramana nirnaye sthiteipi punar ashankyottarapaksham darshayati tatra cha veda shabdasya iti. Even though how to ascertain the means of correct knowing has thus been resolved, the passage beginning tatra cha veda shabdasya anticipates and put and sets forth another doubt. It's actually called the Purapaksha, which would normally mean the opponent's view. Anyway, someone's raising a doubt. Not every Purapaksha has to be the enemy's opinion that has to be smashed. There's a reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt is, what about how are we going to know the Vedas and Kali Yuga? What are we going to do? Continuing, Sampati Kalau Aprachara Rupatvena Durmedastvena Cha Dushparatvat. Now, the word Sampati, that means in the age of Kali. The reason that the Vedas are, quote, impossible to study completely, quote, is that they are not currently available in full, and people have become less intelligent. Okay, then there's a commentary on this. In Anucheda 12, Srila Jiva begins his argument for the supreme authority of Srimad Bhagavatam. The Vedas are the original incontrovertible. Does everybody know what that word means? Incontrovertible. Anybody not know what it means? Okay. Anyway, you can't prove it wrong.
Not indisputable. Indisputable.
Indisputable. The Vedas are the original indisputable scriptural authority. But in this modern age, they can hardly be understood properly. First of all, hardly anyone in our age can claim to have studied the Vedas thoroughly enough and understood them well enough to be a real expert in them. Para, where's para come from? Oh, para means the opposite shore of a river, or by extension, the complete understanding of a topic of study. Okay, dushpara twat. The Vedas in Kali Yuga are dushpara, difficult to fully understand, or difficult to get to the other shore, other side of the river. No one knows the Vedas completely because the Vedas are not even completely available for study. And even those parts that are available cannot be completely deciphered by the less intelligent scholars of modern times. Even if you have enough time to read them all, you're not going to be able to figure out what they mean. Yes? Sorry.
Son.
What is it?
I think it's too loud. Thank you. This was a doubt that came from last class. So the Itihashas and the Puranas have become the scriptures by default, because the Vedas are not available. So my question is that maybe one might say that maybe there is no means of knowing the truth in Kali Yuga. Is there like any statement that...
I'm sorry, this is a little gentle. Why don't you ask, hold it, after we discuss the rest of this on the chain. When we get to the end, why don't we do it then?
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the main arguments seems like it's saying that the Vedas are not completely available. So, but if we take into consideration the fact that the Vedas are actually infinite and nobody can ever completely know them, so then the opponent may argue that it's never the case that the Vedas are completely known or completely available. Always it's only a fragment. So it doesn't make much sense speaking of knowing the Vedas completely. So what do we say? In the sense that if you know only parts of the Vedas, then there could be direct opposition or incompatibility with other parts which we don't know. But if that is the nature of the Vedas, then since they can never be completely known,
Of course, I mean, this is making it a little more complicated. Jiva Goswami doesn't get into this level of argument, but... Okay, no one can know the Vedas completely, not even Lord Brahma. There's probably something that he hasn't read. It's really boils down to a question of how much Vedas is enough to know what you need to know. No one is going to become as completely omniscient as God by studying all the Vedas. No one has the capacity to do that. No one has the capacity to become as all-knowing as God. But living entity he does have his capacity to know to a certain extent, and he has a need for his spiritual purposes, for his liberation and for his entrance into spiritual life, to know a certain amount. So really it's a quite practical question of getting enough Vedas to know what you need to know. You know, so practically, if you want to reformulate it, it's that no one can get enough Vedas. You know, there's a dearth of Vedas, of Vedic knowledge. At least, just like there may be plenty of food, but if your digestion doesn't work, it just goes through your system and you don't get nourishment from it. So we can swallow lots of Vedas, but we don't know how to digest them. So it's a practical question. How can we get enough Vedas to nourish our need for spiritual knowledge? Practically nobody can expect to become all-knowing the way God is. Okay, let's go back. Now we're getting off on general discussions. Let's just stay focused until we complete this anuchet. We're looking now at 12.2. Let me explain that these subdivisions of anuchets with decimal points, 12.1.2, they don't exist in the original sandarbhas. This is an innovation, editorial innovation, to break it up into workable pieces. Because it goes on too long, then when you start commenting on it, the reader has forgotten what you're commenting on. So therefore, it was decision made. Actually, this innovation was originally done by Kushikrata Prabhu, was his idea. We're following the same pattern, but I'm not breaking them up exactly the way he did. But I'm using the idea. Okay, anyway, now we're looking at 12.2. Point 2. Tatahi Mahabharate Manavyecha Itihasa Purana Abhyam Vedam Samupabrimhayit Iti Puranat Puranam Iti Chanyatra Nacha Vedena Vedasya Brimhanam Sambhavati Nahiya Paripurnasya Kanaka Valayasya Trapuna Puranam Yujate. I think we read this yesterday. Thus we read in both the Mahabharata and the Manusamhita. One should complete the Vedas with the Itihasas and the Puranas. And elsewhere it is said, the name Purana comes from the word completion, Purana. Just as one cannot properly fill in the missing part of a broken gold bangle with cheap tin, one cannot complete the Vedas with that which is not also Veda. Nanu yadi veda shabda puranam itihasam chopadate tarhi puranam anyad anveshaniyam yadi tu na natarhi itihasa puranayur abedo vedena uchyate vishisht aik artha pratipadaka padakadambasya apaurushayatvad abedepi Sarvakrama Vedad Veda Nudesho Pyupapadyate. And now here is a real Purvapaksha, a real objection. But if the sound which constitutes the Vedas includes the Puranas and Itihasas, then we need to look within the Vedas for another set of Puranas and Itihasas, a set other than those commonly read. I put that in brackets, added that. Just because there's some confusion maybe about what the objection is here. Otherwise, the Itihasas and Puranas will not be different from the Vedas. I'm sorry? Will not be non-different from the Vedas. Okay, so what this is saying, what the objection is, you know, we hear from the Shastra, from the Vedas, that the Vedas include various parts, and the Puranas and Itihasas are part of the Vedas. Oh, okay. So, the way that some interpret that is that you'll find your actual Puranas and Itihasas among the Vedic texts. That somewhere there are stories and histories, somewhere there are even epic accounts in the Vedas themselves. And that's the real Puranas and Itihasas. And these popular Puranas and Itihasas are fake imitations. They're not the real thing. That's the objection. And if that isn't true, then your popular Itihasas and Puranas are not Vedas. They're something else. They're modern compositions, or, you know, they're written at a different time by different people. And then we have the contradiction that the Itihasas and Puranas are different from the Vedas. If your popular Itihasas and Puranas are the real Itihasas and Puranas. So therefore the Purvapaksha is proposing that the real Itihasas and Puranas are just certain passages of the original Vedas. Okay, let me read the rest of the paragraph. The answer is that they are the reply to the objection. The answer is that they are in fact non-different, because the whole unified collection of words expresses one distinct message. In other words, both have apaurashaya authority, having no human author. In spite of this non-difference, the texts are assigned to separate categories in terms of differences in intonation and exact order. So the answer is that the so-called popular Itihasas and Puranas, they are non-different from the Vedas. That the Vedas, including the original Samhitas and Brahmanas, Aranyakas and Upanishads, the Shruti, that's Vedas, But also the Purana part, at least the Puranas among the Puranas and Itihasas among the Smritis, are also Vedic. The Shruti and the Smriti together, at least the authorized Smritis, are one unified whole. They're the Vedic literature. And they share a unified message, unified purpose, intent, tatparya. And furthermore, both of them are a parashaya. They don't have any human author. Because when we say they're both a parashaya, that means they don't have any author, even the Puranas, ultimately. And even though they're non-different, we say they're different because there are some textual differences. The Vedas have intonations. The Vedics have a somewhat different grammar. And the Puranas are written in a different dialect, without intonation. And the Vedas, every syllable has to be exactly the same in exactly the same order. In the Puranas, there's some leeway in one age after another to recompose it in slightly different words, or in different words. That's understood as the difference of Smriti. That the words can change, but the message is the same. Okay, this will be discussed, I think, in the commentary. Let me move on to the next paragraph and then read the commentary. Rigadi bhiksama mana yora paurasheya tvena abedo madhyandina shruta viva vyajite. Evam ba are sya mahato bhutasya nikshwasitam etad yad rigvedo yajurveda samavedo atarvangirasa itihasa puranam iti adina. This non-difference on the grounds that the itihasas and puranas are as much a paurasheya as the Rig and other Vedas is implied in the passage of the Madhyandina Shruti, which is actually the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Or is it the Chandogya? Do you have the footnote there? I can get it. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which says, this indeed is the breath of this Supreme Being. Thus indeed, the breath of that Supreme Being constitutes the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Angirasa Veda, Itihasa and Purana. Altogether including Itihasa and Purana. This is the breath of the Supreme. Okay, now I'll read the commentary. Goes on. It's a little long. Let's see what it explains. Because the Vedic sound directly emanates from the intelligence of the Supreme Being, all the Vedas and their numerous supplements form a unified whole. Okay, reason why they're a unified whole? Because they're all expressions of the intelligence of the one Supreme Absolute Truth. They are expressions of the same consciousness. The infinite intelligence of the Supreme communicates in different ways with the variously limited intelligence of his countless creatures. He's communicating to us, but his intelligence is infinite, our intelligence is finite. So there has to be some process of translating. He has to express himself in a way we can understand. And when he's talking to different people, he'll be talking in different ways. In the words of Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, yeyata mam prapadyante, tangs tataiva bhajamyaham. I reciprocate with each soul in exact response to how that soul relates to me. So we're applying this statement to this. Krishna communicates differently with different people. Thus the Vedic literature appears to consist of many separate books with numerous categories of texts which seem to have been written at different times for different purposes in different styles of language and by authors with different convictions and different levels of knowledge. But the Vedas explain themselves in another way. And if we are willing to look at the entire Vedic literature from its own point of view, rather than from a foreign critical viewpoint, then with some scrutiny we can see the true picture. The apparent diversity of the texts is due not to their being written by different authors, but to their being intended for several different audiences. Vedic literature is divided into two main kinds of texts, Shruti and Smriti. Shruti, what has been heard, refers to eternal revealed scripture, received by rishis in meditation, and passed down orally through unbroken lines of teachers and disciples. Smriti, what has been remembered, refers to works composed by sages who maintain the message of Shruti without always repeating the exact wording in the same order. The four Vedas are considered Shruti, and each branch of each Veda includes Samhitas, collections of hymns and incantations, Brahmanas, interpretations of rituals, Aranyakas, elucidations of esoterics, and Upanishads, philosophical treatises. From an ordinary point of view, the language and contents of the Samhitas, especially the Rig Veda Samhita, seems the most archaic. The Brahmanas, Aranyakas, and Upanishads seem to consist of speculations by later disciples over the meaning and purpose of the Samhitas. They appear to have been written in a variety of successively newer dialects, gradually approaching classical Sanskrit. That means the Brahmanas are in a more prose style, and the grammar starts to approach what we know as classical Sanskrit grammar. It's sort of hybrid in between. And then the Aranyakas and Upanishads, even more. Some of the Upanishads seem to sound very archaic, because the language is very Vedic. But some of them, it's practically the same language as the Puranas. The Upanishads seem as if an altogether different sort of work, discussing otherworldly concerns hardly touched upon in the, quote, older, ritually oriented Shruti. So there are many superficial reasons for critical scholars to disregard the claim of the Vedas themselves to be a single, coherent whole. This is the Indologist's misfortune. Without a realized understanding of the methods of Shabda Pramana, they can only try to dissect the separate organs of the Vedic corpus, unable to see that the organism is alive. From one viewpoint, a plant's appearing in various stages of growth, seed, sprout, flower, fruit, can be seen as a sequence of distinct events belonging to different times. Viewed another way, however, since generations of the same kind of plant has existed in the past and will continue to exist in the future, each new plant simply copies the permanent genetic plan. In essence, the seed of the species is no older than the fruit. And so it is with the Vedas. We can understand that the eternal Vedas temporarily reveal parts of themselves to human beings at various points of history in the cycle of ages. Just as Sri Krishna, whom Srimad Bhagavatam calls Swayam Bhagavan, the original personality of Godhead, or in other words, the oldest person, appears on earth as an avatar in the dynasty of the moon god, 56 generations after its founder, the Vedas also descend to earth at specific times, though they are co-eternal with the Supreme Lord. Thus the language of the Rig Veda may seem to be an ancestor of later, so-called later Sanskrit, but in reality the two are the same language with simultaneously existing dialects, one liturgical and the other vernacular. Liturgical means you use it in the church, you know, for worship. And vernacular means you use it on the street to talk to people. Various sages composed different kinds of smritis. Some sages wrote these smritis. Some wrote handbooks to explain the details of Vedic sacrificial performances. Shrauta sutras for major sacrifices and Grihya sutras for rituals performed at home. Manu and others compiled law books, the Dharma Shastras. So there are three kinds of sutras, actually. Shrauta Sutras, Griha Sutras, and Dharma Sutras. Later on, the Dharma Shastras were written in different form, as in verse form, rather than sutras. So like the Manusmriti is in verse form. So you have two different varieties of Dharma Shastras. You got the sutra form and the verse form. Although their contents is basically the same. But you have three, traditionally, back in the Smriti, in the Smritis that are the very first commentaries on the Shrutis, you have three varieties of sutras. And they're actually written in sutra form. The Shrauta Sutras that tell you how to perform public, big, complicated Vedic sacrifices, and Griha Sutras that tell you how to do home sacrifices, do-it-yourself home sacrifices, and samskaras. And then third, the Dharma Sutras, which were later supplemented by various smritis, Dharma Shastras. All of these were written by various sages, in various ages. Okay, but especially important for the spiritual education of the general public, because these sutras are really for Brahmins, for Brahmin specialists. For the rest of the public, especially important are the itihasas, epics like such as the Ramayana and Mahabharata, and the Puranas. These works, written in simple spoken Sanskrit, aim at explaining all aspects of Vedic knowledge to the common person, often through entertaining historical narratives. Although both the Itihasas and the Puranas describe the ancient history of the universe, the Itihasas, the epics, generally concentrate on single heroes or stories, whereas the Puranas deal with an assortment of topics. There are 18 major Puranas, including Srimad Bhagavat Purana, and at least as many secondary Puranas or Upa Puranas. In the present age, Kali Yuga, efforts to understand the Vedic texts directly are almost sure to be frustrated. In Kali Yuga, truly qualified Brahmins are rare. Those who are Brahmins in name only, or belong to less educated classes, cannot understand the Shruti scriptures. I think that means not the Brahmins, but other people. Let me make a note. This is a question about those who belong to less educated class sound like not Brahmins. Cannot understand the Shruti scriptures. There are simply too many Shruti texts for a less intelligent person to read through. What to speak of comprehend? The Vedic world of tens of thousands and millions of years ago was a different place, with educated people much more capable of understanding subtle topics, unfamiliar and inscrutable to us today. Moreover, today's extant commentaries on the Vedas, like Sayanas from the 14th century, are too recent to provide reliable insight into the original intentions of the text. Sayana was a smarter Brahmin. He wasn't a Vaishnava, so his commentary on the Vedas is the best we have, but we can't rely on it too much. It just doesn't have the insight, he doesn't really know well enough. The orthodox philosophical darshans each claim a Vedic connection. But except for Jaimini's Mimamsa philosophy and Dvaipayana's Vedanta, they all merely pay lip service to a Paurashaya Shabda Praman, in practice or ignoring it. Karma Mimamsa minimizes the authority of the Upanishads and their approach to the Absolute Truth. Gautama's Nyaya school and Kanada's Vaisheshika study study only the logic and structure of the physical world. and in opposition to the Upanishads, the Sankhya philosophy of the atheist Kapila, and the yoga system of Patanjali, consider material nature the prime cause of creation, and the soul or God only a passive witness. In general, the standard darshans disagree with one another on major points of epistemology and ontology. How do you know and what do you know? And the existing commentaries on the ancient sutras of each of these schools, that's the sutras of the darshans, are all younger than 2,000 years, far removed in time from the actual Vedic civilization. Therefore, in the modern age, the Itihasas and Puranas assume special value. Itihasa Purana Abhyam Vedam Samupabrimhayet. One should complete the Vedas with the Itihasas and Puranas. Although the Vedas are complete in themselves, our modern understanding of them needs to be made more complete. And for this we should rely on the Itihasas and Puranas. It's not that there's holes in the Vedas, but our understanding has holes in it, and that has to be completed. And it can't be done with cheap tin. You have to have Vedic authority to fill in the gaps in our understanding. As many authoritative sources attest, the Itihasas and Puranas are faithful to Shruti, so much so that the Upanishads call them the fifth Veda. They are available and not difficult. They give us access to understandings of ancient wisdom that would otherwise be untraceable. There's originally 1 billion verses of the Puranas. Vyasadeva, at the end of every, whoever the Vyasadeva is, at the end of each Dwapara Yuga, abridges it to 400,000 shlokas. There's supposed to therefore be 400,000 shlokas in the total of the 18 Puranas. And if you count them, you get pretty much 400,000 is the total. So it matches up. We seem to have, although things have been changed, but at least quantitatively it's the right volume of Puranas as it's supposed to be. We seem to have all the Puranas. They're available. Okay. The opposing opinion addressed in text 13.2. Uh-oh, that's not 13.2. We're not up to 13 yet. It's 12.2. Or 12.3. Ah, it says 13. I say 13.2, but it's really 12.3, right? Yeah. Wait, let me change it. I'll just change it. 12.3. Centers. The opposing opinion addressed in text 12.3 centers on the view held by some ritualistic brahmanas. This is the thing about the Itihasa and Puranas actually being part of the Vedic text, and not the separate books are bogus. So, this view held by some ritualistic brahmanas and impersonal Vedantists, ritualistic brahmins and impersonal Vedantists, who acknowledge the authority of the Shruti, but not most of the Smriti texts. So they don't want to accept our Puranas and Itihasas as authoritative. According to this opinion, when Shruti texts enjoin that one should recite the Itihasas and Puranas, they refer not to the more recent texts, now called as such, but to certain passages of the original Vedas. In support of this view, some Vedic passages fit the functional definition of Itihasas narrations. The rest of this next sentence I'm going to have to delete because I can't find the references. Like the portion of the Rig Veda Samhita. Forget it. I mean, there's some two examples given, but I can't identify them, and I don't even know what the passages talk about. So, Baladeva Vidyabhushan referred to them, but I couldn't identify them. So I'll skip that and go to the next sentence. For example, the Taittiriya Upanishad says, Yato va imani bhutani jayante. From that supreme, everything in existence was generated. And etasmad atmanaha akashak sambhuta. From that supreme soul, the sky came into being. So that sounds like a Puranic description of the creation, the history of the creation, in the Taittiriya Upanishad. So that fits the claim that the real Puranas are inside the, they're not separate books, they're inside the Vedas. Therefore, this view concludes, the popular recently composed Smritis cannot be the real itihasas and puranas, and cannot correctly be equated with the perfect eternal Vedas. Srila Jiva Goswami replies by confirming that all the Vedic literature, from the Rig Veda through the Puranas, is essentially a single conception. Only because the language of the Shruti and Smriti are different, are the texts designated separately. The Vedic dialect pronounces each syllable with one of three intonations not used in classical Sanskrit. And in Smriti texts, the exact sequence of every syllable is... Oh, it's backwards. Okay, I can fix it. And in Shruti texts, the exact sequence of every syllable is perpetually fixed, while Smriti can be spoken again in different words in each cycle of ages. Fixed it. The Briharadaranyaka Upanishad is also referred to by the name Madhyandina Shruti, because its best known recension belongs to the Madhyandina branch of the Vajrasayani White Yajur Veda. But there actually is, and Jiva Goswami does quote from it once, a second version of the Briharadaranyaka Upanishad that belongs to a different version of the White Yajur Veda, the Kanva. There's a Vajrasayani White Yajur Veda, there's also a Kanva White Yajur Veda, and there's a different version, a slightly different version, just slightly different version of the Briharadaranyaka Upanishad. And even this verse we're quite quoting, is a little bit different than that version. Jiva Goswami will quote it later. But the Madhyandina branch is the well-known version of the Briharadaranyaka Upanishad. The less-known version is the Kanva version. That you usually don't see, the same Upanishad showing up in two different chakras, in two different forms. Usually you just have different Upanishads in different chakras. Which? Does? Okay. Well, Isha Upanishad is right there in the Vajrasayani White Yajur Veda. It's chapter 40. Because the Atharva Veda appeared in the meditation of two sages, Atharva and Angira, it is sometimes called, the Atharva Veda is sometimes called the Atharva Angirasa Veda. Okay, that's the end of the commentary. That's the end of this 12th Anuchet. I made a long commentary because I'm trying to give a good argument for the authority of the Itihasas and the Puranas based on the authority of the Vedas. Yes, okay, and then we'll go to Nityananda and then Gopal.
It seems like some people, they consider the Smritis are just those sutras, like they have some, I think 24 Smritis are there, and Puranas is a separate category.
I don't know, it's sort of, there's a convention that when you meet, it depends on what discourse, what department of discourse you're talking in. When you're talking about Dharma Shastras, then you call them Smritis. When you're talking about rituals, you call the Sutras Smritis. I don't think anybody means that by that only those, that category, subcategory is Smriti. But that's the only Smriti they're interested in when they're talking about rituals. And when they're talking about rules for behavior, then they're looking at the Dharma Shastras, and they call either one of them Smriti. I don't think they mean that the Puranas are not also Smriti. It's just conventional usage of the word in a certain context.
Yeah. Because I once spoke to one Sri Vaishnava. It's just a matter of formality. Maybe
maybe in Sri Vaishnava or somebody, they limit the use of Smriti.
Yeah, and Puranas, they is like Shruti, Smriti, and Puranas. Like the that's what he
really?
Added. Yeah, so I just wanted to, if you know something about
Well, here, Jiva Goswami and Baladeva Vidyabhushan, they have no problem with including Puranas and Itihasas as part of Smriti. And Baladeva Vidyabhushan was talking about these other Smritis as if all of it altogether is Smriti. So at least our Acharyas, Jiva and Baladeva, they're not so... they don't see a limited definition of Smriti. Samana, do you want to answer that question that I stopped you on? No, we're time to do it now.
Well, are the Itihashas and Puranas like always with the Vedas?
Always
with the Vedas, like are the eternal scriptures, is it like they're always available, or
are they always available?
Yeah. Or is it sometimes it's just the Vedas?
It seems the way things are described, they're always available.
Okay.
There's always a need for them.
And how come they are still available and the Vedas are not? Is there like a particular...
Well, because there's an audience for them. The Vedas get forgotten because nobody's studying them carefully. When the study, you know, when very few people or nobody is studying something, then it gets forgotten. But the Puranas have got a big audience. So therefore the Puranas are still around because people are reading them.
Because people have...
They're on the, you know, the New York Times bestseller list. Well, not quite, but in India, they're on the bestseller list. You go to any train station and you can buy a Purana on that platform.
Because people have become more degraded.
They're less educated. Let's say less educated. Be
okay.
Polite about it.
Okay, sorry. And the qualification needed to read the Shrutis is high.
Yeah, you got to be a well-trained Brahmin. Well-educated Brahmin.
Yes, anybody can read the Itihashas and Puranas.
Well, if you know Sanskrit. If you don't know Sanskrit, someone's going to have to translate it for you. They're written in Sanskrit, the original Puranas. There is a limit. If you don't know Sanskrit, then someone's going to have to give you a translated version of them also. But we have translations and we have people speaking the Itihasas and Puranas in the vernacular. But the books are in Sanskrit.
Actually, my original question was quite different.
Go ahead.
Maybe it's way off topic.
Well, okay, why don't you hold off until I handle a few other questions and we'll come back to you. Because, okay, Vishnukantapu has his hand.
And
then Kishore. And then, okay, anyway, let's go around and we'll come back to you.
Yeah, and if you feel it's not relevant, we can maybe discuss.
Well,
it
we get to the end, then. But I need 5 minutes at the end to talk about some other things. Yeah.
So here Jiva Goswami poses a Purva Paksha that some people say Puranas and Itihasas that are separately there as different categories, they are not mentioned by the Madhyandana Shruti here. I mean the Puranas Itihasas mentioned in this Upanishad refers to those things which are part of the
Well,
Vedas.
Yeah, they're not saying that explicitly, but they're implying that because if they were actually part of the breath of the Supreme, they'd be authoritative. And they're arguing that your popular Itihasas and Puranas are not authoritative.
So he refutes that just by saying the Puranas, Itihasas and the Vedas, everything together have a single message and a single purport to it.
Yes.
But is he going to further prove this presumption that he is making here as a part of his reputation, or is just like he's going to a different topic later? Because this statement which he makes itself can be again, I mean, may not be accepted completely.
Yes, the person, it has to be accepted with faith in the authority of the person saying it. You're not going to be able to prove the authority of the Vedas to start with, of any Shabda Praman, or to speak of the Bhagavatam, to a faithless person. He won't accept it, no matter what you say, no matter how you argue. You'll never convince him by logic. If a person isn't willing to accept your authority or the authority of your guru, then no way to prove the authority of the Bhagavatam or of the Puranas or of the Vedas.
So he's saying that these purports, the intent is one which is told in different ways.
Yes, and that's Jiva Goswami's opinion. Jiva Goswami's opinion.
This opinion can be proved? I mean, should be?
No, you have to believe in Jiva Goswami or not believe in him. It's his opinion. How is he going to prove it? How is he going to prove it in a way that convinces a person who doesn't trust him? It won't be done. He can't do it. He's not trying to do it. He's not trying to convince a person who doesn't trust him. If you trust me, I'll tell you my opinion that the Vedas, Itihasas, Puranas and Vedas all express one supreme unified intelligence. And I can show you, I can go through, point out how there's a consistency, but you got to follow me. You got to go along with me. If you doubt me and don't accept me as an authority, then I'm not going to even try. And he's not trying to give a logical argument to convince people who are stubborn and don't want to just accept his opinion. All he can do is give, my opinion is this, take it or leave it. He's not trying to make a logical or mathematical proof. He can't do it.
Does Baladeva Vidyabhushan tries to prove that also, or in his commentaries?
No, Baladeva Vidyabhushan carries it a little more further, but he doesn't. He's also, you look at the commentaries. Look at the commentaries in the Bhagavad Gita. Look at Baladeva's commentary. It's quite difficult, but it's also quite short. Look at the commentaries in the other sampradayas, at Padavanavali of Vedanta Deshika, at Vijaya Dvajatirtha's commentary. They're much longer. And they go off on so many logical, what I think are tangents, that you start to forget what the verse was about. They go into these other commentaries on the Gita, and the other sampradayas, tend to be quite extensive and quite detailed logical arguments. Our commentaries, including Baladeva Vidyabhushan's, are not. They stick to the verse and they explain what Krishna said and give it, you know, realizations, and don't get too much into logical argument. So for us, it's more important to find the right person you can trust and hear his opinions than to have everything proven by logic. Because these things are beyond the power of logic. Especially to convince a person who doesn't want to believe. That's what achintya means in the Achintya Beda Beda Tattva. Achintya means you're not going to prove it by just logic or just by, you know, physical evidence. You know, by checking the DNA of Vyasadeva, you'll prove the age of the Vedas. You won't do it by physical or logical proof.
Also, there was another point about this Shayanacharya's commentaries on the Vedas. He's supposed to be a Karma Mimamsika, isn't it?
Supposed to be a what?
Karma Mimamsika.
I don't know if he was a Karma Mimamsika or just smarter. Smart scholar. I maybe he is.
I think Vagisha.
I heard that he was. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is Vagisha Prabhu? He was explaining that.
Okay, I haven't heard that myself. That he was particularly a follower of Jaimini.
But it was stated that, because we don't have proper commentaries on the Vedas, so it is not possible for the people to understand the exact purport. Especially, but I heard
we do that, have. Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
And a few acharyas, Madhvacharya, a few others have written actual commentaries on small parts of the Vedas.
I heard most of the other texts like Samhitas and Aranyakas also and Upanishads have been covered by other the descendants of Madhvacharya like Raghavendra Tirtha and Vidya Vachaspati Tirtha, like that in different times. They have written elaborate commentaries, it seems, on.
I don't know, I'm not familiar how much has been commented on.
Some of them might be lost, but most of them are, they covered most of it seems, except for a few parts.
Okay, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is preferred studying Srimad Bhagavatam. The time you spend reading all the Vedas is time you're not reading Bhagavatam. So you have to, life is short. You got to place priorities. What are you going to spend your time reading?
I mentioned because it was mentioned that only his commentary was there, and
which
Sayana. I said that others are also.
I'm sorry. I didn't know that the later acharyas in the Madhva Sampradaya wrote commentaries on almost all the Vedas. I didn't know that. No. Yes. Yeah, I'm just giving Sayana as an example.
You didn't say that it's the only one.
Yeah, and I don't want to criticize the Vaishnava commentaries, whatever ones there are. So I picked on Sayana because he's fair game for criticizing. Bhargava? Yeah, he wrote on 40 suktas. Yeah. And then later?
Then he said that anybody who has a
and he can figure out the rest just by studying these first 40 suktas. He,
right.
But later, there's only the name. Like when we went to this this Gopalabhatta, he was this Kalpa person. And then he said that there are references to some Trivaivarta composition by Raghavendra Tirtha, where he has commented on three Vedas fully.
But we don't have that, right? It's not available?
Yeah, it's not available.
Okay, so the reference is mentioned that such a thing exists, but we don't have them. We don't have those commentaries.
Even in Mantralaya, he didn't get it. He was asking us if you can find it in some British library or somewhere.
Okay, it's like the Holy Grail. I don't know where it is. Okay. Someone can study it, but we do have to focus our study on Bhagavatam. We should. Kishore Prabhu. No major ones. There's a book, it's like an anthology called Itihasa Samuchaya, which is an anthology of miscellaneous stories. I don't even know the source of it, who wrote it. So there might be some minor and more recent epic histories, but these two are the big ones, the classical ones. Yes?
Sorry, I wrote a commentary on Rigveda. It used to show that Vishnu is the lord of Rigveda. It's not that Vaishnavas are just some sentimental people just based on Puranas.
Yes.
So there was a need for that. So, and actually, there's one recent commentator on Rigveda, Kapali Shastri. Kapali
yes.
Shastri. So he acknowledges in his introduction that these kinds of messages in the air that Rigveda, Vishnu, devotion to Vishnu is not Vedic. Such notions, they can be nurtured only until a person reads Madhva's commentary, and he shows that even in Rigveda, Vishnu is the Aradhya deity.
Yes.
More than making it as a like substitute for Bhagavatam, I don't think that was his mood.
Yes. Yes. I'm really sorry. Could you hold it till tomorrow and let you ask the question at the beginning of class? Because I got some things that had to be discussed. Okay, no. If it can be answered short, quickly.
They say, moreover, today's extant commentaries on the Vedas like Sayana's are too recent to provide reliable insights into the original intentions of these texts.
He wrote it in the 14th century AD.
So can we use the same logic for the Puranas? Say, well, we just...
When were the Puranas written?
In Dwarpa. I guess they were written in...
They're actually much older than that.
The Puranas?
Yeah, they existed in some form.
Yeah.
They exist on the heavenly planets. Mm. One book, 1 billion verses. So they're a lot older than 14th century AD.
Yeah, but
at least as far as we're concerned.
Yes. So, but the logic that you use here is that the commentaries on the Vedas are too recent to provide...
Yeah, 14th century AD is too recent. Unless they can base themselves on what was said thousands of years before, that's you know, they're just guessing off the top of their head in the 14th century, it's too recent.
But can we say the same thing about the commentaries on the Puranas?
Which commentaries on which Puranas?
Well, like any commentary on the Puranas.
We only have commentaries on a few Puranas.
Yeah.
On Bhagavatam and on Vishnu Purana by Sridhar Swami and one other person. The other Puranas, we basically don't have commentaries. So I don't think we have to argue about the authority of the commentaries that don't exist. All we have is Bhagavatam, basically Bhagavatam and two commentaries on Vishnu Purana. And the Bhagavatam commentaries, why do we accept them? Because we accept Sridhar Swami on the say-so of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Even though he's not that old. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepts him explicitly, completely. And we accept Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If we didn't, then we'd have a problem. Then he could argue, it's too recent.